Well, just as the Earth's spin on its axis causes day and night, and our planet's annual orbit around the sun is responsible for the ongoing cycle of the seasons, what if there is some greater celestial cycle lasting thousands of years, slowly influencing the rise and fall of civilizations across the globe? Where's the evidence? What could be the cause? In a moment, we will talk with a very special guest, lost star of myth and time, Walter Cruttenden on Coast to Coast AM. Walter Cruttenden is an amateur theoretical archaeo-astronomer, what a title, and author of The Binary Theory of Precession. As the executive director of the Binary Research Institute, he researches the celestial mechanics of the precession of the equinox, as well as myth and folklore related to this phenomenon. He's the writer-producer of The Great Year, a documentary film that explores evidence of astronomical cycles of time known to cultures throughout the ancient world. Most recently, he wrote Lost Star of Myth and Time, a book that provides an alternative view of history based on the solar system's motion through space. It is his belief that the myth and folklore depicting a repeating cycle of golden ages and dark ages may have a basis in fact due to the alternating stellar forces that affect Earth as our solar system moves in a 24,000-plus-year binary dual-star orbit. He's our guest tonight on Coast to Coast. Hey, Walter, how are you?
Hey, great, George. How about yourself?
Good. And by the way, thank you for giving up an hour for our other guest. This was a very important subject in the fact that he believes that this period could be a holocaust for us. I just thought I had to talk with him a little more at length. So I appreciate it, and we'll make it up to you one day as well.
I understand.
This is a fascinating theory. As a matter of fact, one of my very favorite guests of all times talks about your book, and I want everyone to just have a little understanding of where we're headed here. Graham Hancock, Fingerprints of the Gods, writes, "Lost Star of Myth and Time is a wonderful, stimulating, thought-provoking new or very old approach to the oldest enigmas of human history. If Walter Cruttenden is right, as I very much suspect he is, then he has found the key to the mystery of the ages." That's a pretty good comment coming from Graham Hancock, my friend.
Yes, Graham is a great guy, and his book, Fingerprints of the Gods, was a bit of an inspiration to me. In that book, he talked about evidence of ancient civilizations, which he found all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
And he kept running into the myth and folklore about the precession of the equinox, but he didn't quite know why. And then there's also another book you're probably familiar with, Hamlet's Mill.
Oh, yes.
By Giorgio Santolina, who was a professor of the history of science at MIT. And he, too, talked about the prevalence of this myth. As a matter of fact, he said there were at least 31 ancient cultures that talked about the great year cycle with golden ages and dark ages. But, of course, we just grew up thinking it was myth and folklore. And, you know, as a boy myself, I was just fascinated with ancient civilizations and read about Harappa and Mohenjo-Daro and their, you know, fabulous civilizations and water systems, Mesopotamia, which all seemed to decline, of course, ancient Egypt that declined, and everything kind of went down into a dark age, and then the Renaissance came along, and things have been going up, at least technologically, since then.
At least so far, right?
Right. And of course, I got in school, and they taught me that, well, everything's just linear, so that just kind of glossed over these great civilizations that had declined all over the world.
What would have happened, Walter, had these great civilizations, which were doing some wonderful things in their own time period, had continued along that same progression?
Well, we'd probably be in a much different world now, but that's not consistent with the cycle of day and night. Day doesn't just continue forever. The seasons of spring and summer, you know, change to fall and winter. and these are caused by celestial motions. Well, the ancients tell us this greater cycle, this precession of the equinox, this roughly 24 to 26,000 year cycle, is also caused by an orbital motion. And so, reading Graham's stuff, I could see he was getting at this issue of precession. So I just started studying it and set up the institute to do that, and finally, read every old text I could find, and found that there was a fair amount of folks, especially through myth and folklore, talking about there being another star or a companion to the sun that drove this cycle. Just like the cycle of the seasons is driven by an orbital motion.
How would they know that, Walter? When, they didn't have telescopes, at least I don't think they did.
Well, that's true, although there has been some evidence of crystal lenses found and mm-hmm. other types of lenses, which Robert Temple goes into at great length in some of his books. But if indeed there was a higher age, then they may well have known things that were lost. For example, Aristarchus of Samos, the Greek who talked about the heliocentric system.
And what time period are we talking about?
This is about 400 or 500 B.C.
All right.
And then that knowledge of a heliocentric system is lost for about 2,000 years until Copernicus rediscovers it in about 1500. We found the Babylon Battery. There was knowledge of how to store electrical energy, and that dates to at least 2,000 to 4,000 year BC, and that was lost.
As a matter of fact, that battery fascinates me because it was soldered, it had copper in it, it obviously had acid in it, which you need as an electrolyte. Somebody knew what they were doing.
Yes, yeah. Unfortunately, it was when it was found, it was moved out of context, so we really don't know the circumstances under which it was originally found.
And what about its purpose? What do you think they used it for?
It's hard to tell. It could be electrolysis to put metal coatings on jewelry, that sort of thing.
Could it have been a light bulb or something?
It could have powered a very low watt light bulb, but again, I wouldn't go that far just because we haven't found the light bulb. But there's all sorts of devices. How about the Antikythera device? This is this geared device. It was found in 1901, although really not realized until about 1950 when somebody dropped this encrusted hunk of metal in the museum. And it broke open, and they found out that it has at least 20 gears in it. And the shipwreck that it dates to is around 80 BC. Well, we were taught in school that gears weren't developed until the great clockmaking area, 12, 13, 1400s in there. And so there's a lot of these anomalous artifacts to hint at higher ages, long before the Dark Ages.
Might there have been, Walter, very high technology back, even beyond what we think might have been normal civilizations, maybe 1 million years ago, 2 million years ago?
There might have been. I know that Cremo talks about that in his book, Forbidden Archaeology.
Right.
I think we always want to extrapolate our own paradigm and figure that, a more advanced civilization would have better telephones or cell phones or computers or office buildings. And, maybe there's just a whole different paradigm if the ancients are right about these four ages, which the Greeks called the Iron, Bronze, Silver, Golden Ages, and, the Vedic Indians had still different names for. They describe the higher age not so much as one where man is fascinated with technology. As a matter of fact, they hint that that's a very low age. They say higher age is, Hesiod in particular talks about this, is a time that man lives in tune with nature, and there's a very harmonious pattern that exists on the Earth. So, you know, I'm not sure that we're really going to find evidence of really fancy technology if we go way, way back in the record, although we certainly do find some things that were rediscovered in the Renaissance period.
Well, let's go back then to the beginning of your work and research, the precession of the equinox. Kind of explain what that is, first of all, if you can, Walter.
Sure. The equinox, of course, is that day of the year that the night and day are of equal length. And so it's used as a point of measurement. And if you, say, sat on one of the pyramids on that day and looked straight east over the Sphinx, you would see a particular constellation rising on, let's say, the spring equinox. And if this was about 2,000 years ago, you would have seen, or say 4,000 years ago, it would be Aries at that point. And then about 2,000 year, Pisces was just coming into view. And very soon, it's Aquarius. That's why they call it the dawning of the age of Aquarius. So this precession of the equinox, it's just a way to mark this our time in this vast cycle, this 24 to 26,000 years that it takes the equinox to precess through all 12 constellations that lie along the ecliptic, the ancient
constellation. Now, why was this so important, let's say, to the ancient people?
Now, that is the big $64 question. Why does every ancient culture talk about this? And if it is just a mere wobbling of the Earth, it's hard to imagine why it would be important. But they also attached these great year myths to it. They hinted that it's a way to keep time where we are, closer to a dark age or a golden age. And we have found that precession, the observable precession, the equinox moving through these different constellations, can be produced not just by a wobbling Earth, but could actually be produced by the solar system curving through space. You can produce the same phenomenon.
Is it a clock of calamity, Walter? Do these events occur to a point where these ancients realize, something's going to be pretty catastrophic here, something's going to happen?
Well, many of the myths do hint at that, and especially the Assyrians, they found over 100,000 cuneiform tablets, many of them at the Museum in Nineveh, that date back quite some time, and they were actually in a descending age, unlike us now in an ascending age, and they hinted how the past was so wonderful and beautiful, and they wanted to recreate it, and when they recreated buildings, they tried to make them exact, and they dreaded the future. And sure enough, the world went into a dark age. Sumer, Akkad, Babylon were wiped off the face of the earth. And then, after the dark age, we've had the Renaissance. And so we're, according to this clock, the ancients actually used the autumnal, the fall equinox rather than the spring equinox.
Okay, so the thrust of your theory is that the sun has another partner somewhere, right?
Yes, and it is this mass that is causing the solar system to curve through space, producing the phenomenon that we call the precession of the equinox. You know, what it is it's just a change in the orientation of the Earth. And think about Ptolemy's time. They saw the sun rise in the east and they set in the west, and so they were convinced the sun went around the Earth.
Sure.
You couldn't tell them otherwise. Hey, I can see it rise over there, set over there.
Yeah, we see it moving.
Yeah, tell me it doesn't move. And what they didn't realize was the Earth was spinning. Well, the same thing is occurring now. We've lost sight of a reference frame. Not only is the Earth spinning and orbiting the sun, but the entire solar system is curving through space, and it is that motion which produces the bulk of the observable of the precession of the equinox.
Does our solar system have its own orbit around something?
Yes, I believe it does. And, you know, 50 years ago it was thought that binary star system, stars that orbit each other or orbit a common center of mass, were rare. And then 20 years ago, it was realized, wow, it's maybe half of all stars. And the latest estimate I just read on the NASA Chandra website is 80% of all stars are in binary or multiple systems. So you have to ask, you know, why wouldn't our sun be part of such a system?
Where would this other star partner be?
Well, we're trying to figure that out.
Can we see it with a Hubble, for example?
Well, what we can prove is that the Earth does not wobble the same amount relative to objects within the solar system that it does relative to objects outside the solar system. So it does show that our solar system is curving through space. And we know that it takes a very heavy mass to cause something as massive as our sun and solar system to, you know, change angular direction. So there's something there, and there's good scientists that are talking about this. Richard Muller at Berkeley, John Anderson has talked about it a little bit at Caltech JPL. But we don't see something that fits Newtonian mechanics. So in that scenario, one must assume that it is a brown dwarf, maybe a red dwarf against a galactic center.
Okay, which would be even more difficult to find.
Or something like that. There is a whole other scenario, though, for a possible visible star. But that takes us into the world of non-Newtonian dynamics. And there's a theory out there called MON, Modified Newtonian Dynamics, which is gaining some popularity.
Might this be the very bright star we see all the time?
It very well could be. As a matter of fact, there's quite a bit of a myth and folklore about a few stars. And
one being, of course, Sirius, right?
Yes, absolutely. You know, Sirius was Isis to the Egyptians. Some would even say that it's Marduk or Nibiru.
Mm-hmm.
And it's relatively close, 8.6 light years away.
And others believe that an extraterrestrial race came to this planet from that star system.
I've heard some of that. I'm trying to stick to the hard physics of it all. And so we're still having an issue with how on Earth our system could get around Sirius in 24,000 years when Newtonian dynamics says it would take, you know, millions of years.
Well, that's a good point.
Yeah, but there are...
How could if that's true, how could that happen?
Well, there's some new theories of gravity out there that are quite interesting, that say we're going much faster than we have thought for...
What if we go through some kind of warp portal or something to get there? Is that possible? I don't, even a wormhole. Maybe we're not ripped apart like some people say we could be.
You know, I think that... I think it's probably simpler than that, just intuitively. There's a scientist down at the University of Adelaide who has said that he believes our solar system might be going 450 to 500 kilometers a second.
Wow.
Which would get us around that point. Also, if you look at what's happened to some of our spacecraft as they near the edge of our solar system, Pioneer 10 and 11 specifically, they're not where they're supposed to be.
Right, that's true.
And, you know, this is a well-known phenomena, and there's lots of people are studying it. And so it could be that, you know, as Einstein said, the gravity works a little differently on a very large scale, and maybe it works a little differently than we think just outside our solar system.
Stay with us. We're going to talk more about this binary star system. The Mayans, the Hopis, they had a lot to say about this. And what about an ancient spark plug that was found? What's that all about? I'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with our guest Walter Crittenden. Walter, the Mayans, the Hopis. Let's talk about the Mayans first. What did they say about these possibilities?
Well, both of them had different names for it. And we do talk about this a little bit in my book, Lost Star. But whereas the Vedic Indians called it Yugas, the Greeks called it Ages, the Hopi called it suns and or worlds, and the Mayans called it suns. So I think the Mayan is the fifth sun, and we're hearing a lot about that now in the with the 2012
right, we're getting close to that
phenomena. We sure are, yeah. And I'll say up front that I don't know really what that means, but I do find it amazing that the Mayans could so long ago get very close to the date of this alignment of the winter solstice, December
21st,
2012, with the galactic center. Because even NASA confirms that that happens roughly between 1990 and 2020, depending on where you pinpoint the galactic center.
Is it possible that 2012 might not be the date for whatever is to occur, if anything? Or do you think they've got it?
Well, I think they used it as a marker, just as other civilizations use the equinoxes or solstices for markers. And they seem to have the same mythology about changes coming with the changing of the ages. And so it could be that, you know, they had enough memories or mythology of prior cycles, ages, to be able to determine that this when the winter solstice aligns with the galactic center, we're at a point where there's a critical mass of change. And intuitively, I think something is going on. You know,
is it physical change? Is it spiritual change? What do you think they meant?
I'm not sure, but if you look at just sort of the outward evidence, there's sure a rapid expansion in technology. So man's consciousness seems to be expanding, and it shows up as we can invent more stuff. Also, there's interchanges in that. It seems more and more people are interested in higher consciousness, meditation. You know, in the 50s and 60s when I grew up, it was just starting to be talked about. And then I read in Time magazine just the other day, 18 million people are meditating now just in the U.S. So something's going on where more and more people seem to be, you know, reflecting and getting in touch on a deeper level.
Well, now, do you think that the fact that there's a binary star system, are we talking about catastrophes that have and will occur because of this dual star system?
You know, while some of the myth and folklore does make reference to past catastrophes, you know, that the world would be destroyed by flood or fire, that sort of thing. Certainly the flood myth is one of the most prevalent. Here in the ascending ages, they talk about, you know, different levels of being or consciousness more so. And I thought the Greeks put it the best, you know, the iron, bronze, silver, and golden age. It's even mentioned in the book of Daniel and in the Bible. But the lowest age, the Vedic Indians would tell us, is just man's only aware of his physical body and the physical universe, no knowledge of finer forces. And we came out of that just in the last few hundred years with the Renaissance. And at that point, man is supposed to become aware of finer forces. And sure enough, electricity is discovered, magnetism, a microscope, telescope. It seems like all our senses are expanded outwardly through technology.
Well, what's the significance, though, of a binary star system? I don't understand what the tie-in is.
It is the drivetrain. It is the mechanism to move us, to carry the Earth in and out of some point in space where the Earth can be affected in such a way that it would affect the ionosphere, the magnetosphere, crops, climate, consciousness, all that sort of thing.
So it will affect us in some form or fashion.
Yes, and I think it is affecting us. It, just as the sun, you know, every star produces huge electromagnetic spectrums, and we only see visible light coming from our closest star, the sun, but there are, you know, ultraviolet to infrared, to X-rays to radio waves, gamma rays, et cetera. And so do all other stars have these properties. And so if we are in a system that is pulling us closer to and farther away from another star on sort of a cyclical basis, because that's what elliptical orbits do,
right,
then we could very well be affected by by another star in a manner that affects Earth. And, you know, we've just found out, you know, that these X-class solar flares from our sun can have a big impact. You know, they knock out satellites, ham radios get static.
Sure.
Your car radio changes. Well, just in the last few years, people have noticed that that happens on the night side of the Earth. We are getting bursts from, most of them have been traced to soft gamma repeaters, you know, very distant stars. And it can have the same effect as a solar flare in that it can affect satellites, ham radios. There was a gal in Seattle driving home at night. She switched to a Nebraska station. Believe me, the stars can have just as much effect on our Earth as the sun can.
Well, maybe they're also having an effect on the sun.
Yes.
See, what I think is happening in terms of all these hurricanes and global warming and the oceans warming up, and now there's a research study that's out that says this could be a strong possibility. I think the sun is doing a lot of this, not planetary change, but the sun itself. I think the sun is causing the ice shelves to melt and fall off into the sea.
Yes, and there could be a relay effect, George. I think you're right on. Matter of fact, Hans Alfven won the Nobel Prize in 1970 for his realization that there's these waves coming from other stars, Alfven waves they're called, that sort of can interact with our sun and just pluck the Earth and sort of, you know, ring it like a gong, if you will. So we're barely at the in the kindergarten stage of learning of how the Earth's environment and space can affect things here
sure.
on Earth.
And it's possible the binary star could be affecting us as well as maybe we get closer to it?
It could be the binary star itself because all binaries move in elliptical orbits, so we get closer and farther from the center of mass. But it could also be that it's the binary motion just takes us closer and then farther away from another point in space. You know, maybe it's a magnetar, this recently discovered star that has a magnetic field 1,000 trillion times greater than the Earth. You know, it could be some exotic star like that that affects the Earth.
Have the ancients given us any clues, Walter, to help us find what could be the second star?
Well, you know, some of the myth and folklore does relate to Sirius, as mentioned. So if it's a visible star scenario, we need to figure out how that can happen with, you know, what the laws of gravity are outside our solar system that might make that possible. So we're really studying both scenarios right now, sort of the pure Newtonian scenario where it could be something dark, or this this more exotic one. There's also some friends in Canada have a website, Sirius Research Group. com, and they're studying Sirius, and they've done really some amazing work to show that it seems to be acting a little differently than other stars.
The ability of this binary star to do whatever it does to us, of course, could it have been the reason that we had the flood, the Noah's Ark flood, and things like that?
I'm not sure of that, but there is some work by the Russian scientist Milankovitch who showed that these dark ice ages seem to occur somewhat in sync with the precession cycle. And there's also some other cycles. There's a 100,000-year cycle.
Okay.
So if indeed precession, the observable of precession, is due to our solar system's orbit through space, then it would tie with that cycle also.
What do the Hopis now say about this?
The Hopis have passed down some myth and folklore, and they say that you know, I believe we're going from the fourth world to the fifth world. So it's quite similar to the Mayans.
There are similarities. That's what's fascinating all by itself.
It is, yes. The Hopis do get into more detail, though, just because they're more of an existing culture, whereas the Maya were virtually wiped out. And so they talk about...
By the way, for an intelligent race like the Mayans, for what I call a super race at the time, for them to get wiped out, that's a little boggling all by itself, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Boy, you know, they really succumb to some of the Dark Age influences there. Plus, you know, when the white man came over, it probably finished whatever the last vestiges.
Sure, or probably brought disease and things like that.
Were there, yes. There's some stories about that.
Well, back to the Hopi myth.
So, yes, the Hopis talked about there being a very beautiful world in prior times, that there were cities that are now under the seas. You know, a lot of these myths, they're not really explicit, but they seem to hint at a higher age in prior times.
Like an Atlantis-type age?
It sure sounds a lot like that.
It does.
They don't use that word Atlantis, but it sounds very similar to what we have learned of Atlantis through Plato.
Of course, you know, in some of the Vedics, I mean, they talked about flying machines. I mean, so you could be talking about real high technology.
Very possibly, yes. But also maybe a man himself is, you know, of an expanded consciousness in a higher age, and therefore just much more in tune with nature. And so I'm not sure that we need all the outward technology, but we're studying all the myth and folklore we can on this right now.
Walter, tell us about the incredible story that's in Lost Star about this spark plug. I mean, this is a great story.
Well, that's one item, and we've tried to put hundreds in there, and I'm not sure that every single one is true. But in the book Lost Star, which, by the way, people can get at Amazon or Barnes & Noble, there's this geode that somebody found and cut open, and there's a device in it that looks a lot like a spark plug.
And how old do you think it could have been?
Well, geodes would take, you know, hundreds of thousands of years to form.
Okay.
So, unfortunately, the exact circumstances under which it was found are not super clear. So, if indeed it was a geode, then it's very, very old and quite interesting. If it is not a geode, then, you know, then I would.
That's G-E-O-D-E-S, right?
G-E-O-D-E, I believe geode.
Okay, and
right.
You want to do a little work on that.
Right.
But if it was a spark plug, what the heck would it be used for? Do they have old cars in those days?
Yeah, I don't know. You know, when you find things like the Babylon battery, you asked what that was used for. Clearly, they had the ability to create and store electrical charge there. That is a most interesting question.
And I do think the Baghdad battery could have been used as some electroplating device.
Very possibly.
Yeah,
we've sure found a lot of...
But to have the knowledge of that, that's the fascinating part of the story.
And to have it go away, too. You know, I think it shows that there's somewhat of a cycle we're seeing in history here, of course.
Because when did the battery pop back up again? 16th century?
Yes, exactly. 16, 1700s by Volta.
So almost a couple thousand years, easy. I mean, this battery could be 2000 BC. It could be 4,000 years. That technology was lost.
Yes, same thing with gears, the ability to make arches, sophisticated water systems, you know, all these things are lost and through the Dark Ages and then rediscovered in the Renaissance. And that's why history just didn't make sense to me, what I was being taught in school, and I needed to look for something else that made sense, more of a cycle. And this cycle of which Plato called the Great Year, was dominant throughout virtually every ancient culture. And it was really only since, you know, Darwin that we got the purely linear cycle.
What do you think of the work of Zachariah Sitchin?
I've read his stuff, and I think that he's done a great job at recognizing many of the discoveries of the ancient, particularly the Sumerians, where he talks about the trepanation devices for brain surgery, which they've actually found, you know, the physical devices. I disagree with the orbital mechanics of the hypothesized Nibiru. As a matter of fact,
3,600-year elliptical orbit, right?
Right, and something coming within the solar system perturbing the paths of the other planets, just it doesn't make sense. It wouldn't last. It would be ejected or destroyed very quickly. I think you're familiar with Michael Heiser.
Oh, sure. Michael's been on the program a number of times.
Right, so he has an alternative explanation for what Nibiru might be, and he says, of course, that it's a star, and I looked at his work and Sitchin's work side by side, and I really think Kaiser has nailed it. It is a star, and but this language, crossing, it seems to cross, and so that is the classic definition of a binary star. It would move against the grain, so to speak.
Well, do you believe, though, that this planet could have been visited by ancient extraterrestrials?
I think anything is possible, particularly if we were in a higher age at that time. It might have been a more desirable place to come than currently, when it may not be quite as desirable.
Well, it might have been safer then, that's for sure.
Yes, yeah. But, you know, there's stories about these things. I just... I'm trying to stick to sort of the known science right now.
It's not easy just to contain yourself into that arena, though, is it?
No, it's not. But I tell you, the whole Internet is causing this spontaneous collaboration. So just working on the book Lost Star, you know, I've been able to get a hold of astronomers, astrophysicists, people all over the world and collaborate on different aspects of that.
Do you have much support for the binary star theory?
I think it is getting a fairly good audience if I can get enough time to talk to people. And I've filed a few papers on this, on the geometric theory of precession, and just met with some Caltech JPL folks the other day. So it's going to take a while, but we are making some headway.
All right, Walter. Well, let's tap the brain of our coast-to-coast audience and open up the phone lines for you. We'll be back in a moment. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM. What I find fascinating, Walter, about everything in the work in your book, Lost Star, is the tremendous efforts of the ancients, the Egyptians, the Greeks, the Chinese, the Mayans, the Hopis, the Sumerians, all of them in their own cultures, different time periods on this planet, seem to come up with very similar ideas of the universe, of the solar system, of the galaxy. How in the heck did they all do that separately, and it still comes out to be the same?
That's an amazing point, George. This myth about this great year cycle with golden ages and dark ages is prevalent, as mentioned, in at least 31 cultures, according to Hamlet's Mill. And yet... if it was just a myth, you would think that, you know, it wouldn't transfer so easily. That's why we think the precession of the equinox has a real purpose, that we think there's a basis in fact to this. And that's why we've been studying it at the Binary Research Institute. And indeed, we find that the precession of the equinox is not simply due to the Earth wobbling. Yes, there are some local forces from the Sun and Moon acting on the oblate Earth, sort of the classic lunisolar scenario. But the bulk of it seems to be caused from the Earth or the whole solar system orbiting another star.
Now, tell me more about the Binary Research Institute, how you put it together, and the kind of information that comes out of it.
Yes, well, a handful of us, and we've used some full-time folks and consultants from time to time, mathematicians, astrophysicists, and we've tried to study and read everything we could on precession, both from an ancient standpoint and a modern standpoint, and found that it's something that is not very well understood, and it's really nobody's job to figure out if there could be an alternative cause behind precession. And so sure enough, we've found that it does have this other cause. It's due to the geometric effect, just like we talked about in Ptolemy's day. They see the sun moving around, but nothing's really around the earth, so they think the sun moves, yeah. But there's nothing pushing the sun. Well, same thing. There's very little actually wobbling the earth. It's the whole solar system curving through space. So we've written some papers on this, and the book Lost Star of Myth and Time is my attempt here to bring it to the public in sort of layman's terms.
The celestial mechanics involved in this kind of work and research, did you ever come to the possibility that this binary star, this binary system, creates and captures, let's say, comets or asteroids and has some effect on those things?
Yes, there's some work. Whitmire and Matisse have talked about, it could possibly be a binary or some object that causes the shear edge of the Kuiper Belt. There's also seems to be some non-randomness in the long-cycle comet path, and that could be that they're stirred up by a companion star. And that's really Muller's theory up at Berkeley, the sort of the nemesis theory that, this binary orbit stirs things up, and every 26, 30 million years, he's got a very long cycle, it wipes out life here on Earth. He's basing his more on the geological record versus we're basing ours on the actual change in angular direction that the solar system seems to be going through and simply asking, what are we going around?
Let's go to the phones. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hey, good morning, gentlemen. This is Wes in La Jolla, California.
Hi, Wes. Thanks for calling.
One, Kogo 600.
Sure thing.
Here. I'd like to ask Walter if he is familiar with a book by the late Marie Chatelain. It's called Our Cosmic Ancestors. And this gentleman was the telemetry specialist for the Apollo program and a superior mathematician. And he came up with what he called the constant of Nineveh, which was a 64,000-year cycle based on all the things that you've been discussing this evening.
I'm not familiar with the book, but you say it's the constant of Nineveh, like the...
I-N-I-N-E-V-E-H, Nineveh, right?
Interesting. I'll have to look that up.
It's a very interesting read, and he computed all of the locations, very similar to what Richard C. says, about 19.5, this kind of thing. But he computed all of the locations of the major monuments, and particularly the Great Pyramids, the monuments in Europe, Stonehenge, and so on, triangulated, and then he actually computed the molecular weight of the Great Pyramid at Giza. And based on his studies of the Sumerians and the ancient cultures, came up with this constant of Nineveh that came out to about a 64,000-year cycle. And he also, in that book, predicted the pole shift. Not just magnetic, but physical pole shifts that occur, and I believe he said about every 24,000 years, which is about twice the every ice age kind of thing.
Well, you mentioned the megalithic structures, and we find these, all over the world, henges, dolmens, cairns, obelisks, pyramids. They just found another huge pyramid in Iran. How do you lose one of those and not find it for 40 centuries
really?
Later?
Even in South America when they uncover some of these things.
Oh, Corral, Peru, they found those six, and they have excellent dating. It goes to at least 400 years before Giza, and this is top-notch scientists dating it. So, and virtually all of them have some astronomical alignment feature. They're aligned with the equinox or solstices or cardinal points. So something's going on here. Why are all these ancient cultures building these structures all over the globe and so interested in aligning them with celestial coordinates?
They've got to have a purpose. It's not just for art, is it?
I don't think so. You know, when we first heard about Stonehenge, when I was a kid, they said, well, they were hunter-gatherers. They could barely subsist on their crops, so they needed to know when to plant them. So they built this thing, which is so ridiculous because, you know, they would have to go, for some of the rocks, over 100 miles, cut these 50-ton stones, haul them back, align them perfectly so they would know how to then plant their crops.
Yeah. When would they have time to plant their crops doing all that?
Yeah, it's kind of silly. There's something else going on that we don't know yet, and it could be that the ancients realized we were coming into a descending age and building structures to try to hang on to the influence of the higher ages. You know, there's a saying in the Bible in Job, the sweet influence of the Pleiades. And I don't know if that is the source of the electrical or magnetic or electromagnetic effects that the Earth needs, but something's going on in these ancient cultures where they're trying to tell us something.
Let's go back to the phones. First time caller line, you're on Coast to Coast with Walter Cruttenden. Go ahead.
Hi, George. This is Jeff, and I'm calling from I'm driving on I-44 somewhere outside Springfield, Missouri.
Oh, know it well. Go ahead, Jeff.
Okay, George. Hey, I just want to say, first time, long time, love your show. And I had actually had two questions for Walter.
Sure thing. Go ahead.
But he actually took care of the first one before I could get in. My first question was about Atlantis, and he addressed that pretty well. But my second question, Walter, I remember hearing, and after I ask this, I'll hang up the phone, but I remember hearing when I was younger about a perpetual motion machine, and everything that you said about the Babylon battery and the spark plug and the geode just really got me thinking about that. So I was wondering what you thought about maybe the possible existence of a perpetual motion machine in the past or the actual feasibility of that happening. And I'll get off the phone now. Thank you so much, George. You have a great show.
Okay, thank you. In your book, you had something that kind of looked like a perpetual motion machine, Walter. It was that little ball with the two bent openings that, you know, revolved. It was like a little steam engine.
Right. And that was just to show that a steam engine had been developed again long, long before the Dark Ages, was lost, and then, you know, brought back again to commercial use here in what the 1800s, to show that this cycle. You know, a perpetual motion machine goes against our known laws of physics, but I'm sure that there's plenty of energy sources, and I know that you've had guests on your show that talk about it, that are a lot more efficient than our current energy sources. And it could be that, you know, perhaps this is something the ancients were tuning into. The greatest perpetual motion machines are the spinning Earth, the Earth orbiting the Sun, the motion of the heavens themselves. You know, they last as long as the universe lasts.
I notice you write a little bit about the Coral Castle in Florida, Edward Lee Scaldon's place.
Yes, yes. What a fascinating character. Here's a 5 foot, 100-pound man who was able to move stones, some up to 18 tons, by himself. And when asked how he did it, he said, oh, I just used the same method that the pyramid builders used.
but, of course, would never tell us.
Exactly. And once again, he has all these astronomical alignments, a lot of celestial motifs around there. And wrote some very mysterious books that make reference to magnetism.
I was going to say that. I think he somehow understood that every object, you didn't have to be metal, that every object had some form of magnetism in it, and I think he knew how to tap into it.
Yes, I think he had some sort of higher age knowledge. And speaking of magnetism, one of the scientists on our team here, he'll actually be presenting with Graham Hancock and myself at our Sedona conference next month, November 12th. It's called CPAC.
All right. Is that on your website?
Yes, it is. Or it has its own website, cpak2005.com. And Robert Schock will be there, and quite a lineup. John Major Jenkins, the foremost Mayan scholar.
Yeah, you've got the heavyweights.
Yeah, we're trying to all get together to figure out what the ancients were up to here. But John's work on magnetism at his office, he has two giant magnets opposed to each other, locked in devices. He works for CERA Corp, a government think tank. And he has showed that if you put an object in between these, there's about a one-inch gap or so, and move it slowly, you don't feel anything. It can slip in and out easily. But if you try to move it quickly, the magnetic effect takes hold, even if it isn't a metal object. It can be a piece of plastic. And so I think there's some laws of magnetism that we're still to discover.
Ed knew something. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
My name is Sophia. I'm calling from North Hollywood.
Sure. Hi, Sophia.
Hi. I'd like to ask one thing really quick. I think it's worth reiterating the idea that the anomalous artifacts, all these ancient technologies, so supposed advanced lost technologies, it's really not what we're talking about when we speak of a golden age. As he said previously, lost golden age 20,000 odd years ago, this would be... this would be like, say, the Maltese cultures. Actually, I'd like the guest to talk about the Maltese ruins, which go back much further than Stonehenge.
Can you do that, Walter?
Yes, I've not been to Malta, but I've read quite a number of books on it, and actually Graham will touch on this subject in Sedona. You're right. They are older than the pyramids, and
they seem to have a more magical culture.
Yes, and they seem to be—they're not even geometric in shape. They're more womb-like. A lot of these structures,
yes.
Although once again they have these astronomical alignments with the openings often opening to the equinox, and so we don't know much more than that because they didn't leave us any writings. And some would even say, you know, in the higher age, you don't need writing, that again, is something that's invented when we lose our ability to communicate with each other and nature and animals and that sort of thing in the lower ages.
Walter, when you were putting together Lost Star, any one thing that to you was the most fascinating?
Oh, boy. You know, it's the celestial mechanics that really get me off because... You think about it, these celestial motions, they affect everything on Earth. The spinning Earth that gives us night and day, which we're, you know...
I think it's the reason why our magnetic poles are shifting now.
It could very well be, yeah. And also the Earth going around the sun on a slight tilt causes bears to hibernate, fish to spawn, birds to fly south. It affects all life.
Just that perfect angle, too.
Yeah, just because of these heavenly motions. So we know that there are greater heavenly motions. At the very least, we're going around the galactic center. Why wouldn't they have similar effects here on Earth?
Do you think when you look at all this and then you look at what's going on in the universe, do you think that was all random or it was done with a designed hand?
Personally, it looks pretty beautiful to me. I think that there are things that we can't even comprehend, higher intelligences. And
it all fits like a puzzle, doesn't it?
It sure seems to. But what's nice right now, too, is, you know, there's a lot of negativity in the media and plenty of things to worry about when you just look outside. But at the same time, we seem to be evolving fairly rapidly in consciousness, and I think we're at a fairly critical time in the world right here.
Well, I think you're right. I've got several websites for you. Do you have any particular one you want everybody to go to?
Well, the
I've got Binary Research Institute. I got thegreatyear.com. I got loststarbook.com.
They can just go to loststarbook.com. That's probably the easiest to remember. And then from there, get to the hardcore research site, which is Binary Research Institute, or Great Year if they want to hear more about the archaeology and some of the mythology.
Who did the graphics for the cover? Good. Nice job.
Yes, Sean Freeman did a fabulous job there.
All right, stay with us. We'll come right back and take final phone calls on Coast to Coast AM. I'm George Norrie. And our guest, Walter Krutkin, and we'll be back with Walter in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast with Walter Krutkin. He's our guest. You've got our calls. Walter, civilizations throughout the ancient world collapsed. Why? Why did they rise? Why did they fall?
The hypothesis that we have put forward is that as the sun carries our Earth, George, in this great orbit that takes roughly 24,000 years, that we go through a point in space that has beneficial influences to consciousness and detrimental influences. And we're not sure of the exact mechanism, but we believe, we know that all stars create huge electromagnetic forces and that these can affect our ionosphere, magnetosphere. And there's a gal at UCLA who has proven it can even affect consciousness. Her name is Valerie Hunt. She's a former professor of physiology there at UCLA. And she took subjects and put them in a room, a Faraday cage called the Mu Room, and then had them do tests and found out that when she eliminates all the electromagnetic environment from the air, that people break down, they sob and perform very poorly on tests. They feel as if they're threatened, but they don't know why. And when she restored the normal atmosphere and even upped it a little bit, and I think she was adding primarily negative ions to the room, well, then people felt good and performed better on the tests and were had a sense of well-being and didn't know why. So if we can reproduce that in the laboratory, just imagine what is happening to the Earth on a very long scale if our sun is carrying us in and out of such a region of space.
Okay, let's go back to the phones. We'll pick it up by going to our East of the Rockies line. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Hello, this is Alvin.
Hi, Alvin.
Virginia.
Welcome to the show.
You know, what I was wanting to ask is the way that, you know, your guest there, Walter, is talking about the cycles and stuff, would it be possible that the Earth has gone through everything it's already, you know, that's happened here on the Earth? Could it have gone through it before and more or less, when it goes back around into another cycle, would it all start all over again?
That's what the Greeks say. You know, they call one cycle an eon. That's where that term comes from. And they say man has been around for eons and eons going through these cycles from the lowest age, iron, bronze, silver, up to the gold age, and then back down again over and over. The Vedic Indians say the same thing. It is very possible.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, appreciate you being on the program. Next up, let's go to our wild card line. Your turn. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, George.
Yes.
This is Mary from Oregon.
Hi, Mary.
I have kind of a dumb question here, I think, but it's a short one. I'm 82. I don't hear as well as I used to, but I've heard this term, and Walter used it, the Earth rang like a bell. I've never heard the Earth ring like a bell. And I wonder if he means something besides sound.
Well, yes, we're referring more to vibrations. There are waves coming from space that affect the Earth, Alfvén waves and Schumann waves. And John Darien, the physicist I mentioned earlier, thinks that it may even interact with the Earth's own electrical atmosphere here. You know, we have lightning bolts going off millions of times every day. And so it could be that this is the way that the Earth is affected from space. But there are also some very poetic terms to it. The ancients talked about music of the spheres, and no one's quite sure what they were meaning, but maybe they were alluding to this same principle.
It'd be more vibration than sound, then.
I think so. Yes, of course.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank
appreciate you, being on the program. This is going by fast. Let's go to our wild card line again. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hello. Is that for me?
Yes, sir. It's all yours.
Well, this is Charles. I'm calling you from Harlingen, Texas, down in the Rio Grande Valley.
Yes, sir.
I know you, George, you've expressed a lot of interest in that year 2012 down through the years.
Yes, I have.
I've done my little homework through the years on the Mayans. I have a theory, and I'll tell you what my theory is, see what the both of you think about
it. Okay.
The Mayans called an age I'm forgetting my train of thought. They had a name for age called a sun. They called it a sun.
Correct.
And I think they called they said that what was going to be unusual is that we were going to go through a back-to-back, I believe, red sun, a red dragon sun, which is supposed to be terrible, horrible. Everybody gets maimed and killed and brutalized for a period of 260 years. That's the age of a Mayan sun. And they said we were going to go through two of them back-to-back, which would be 520 years. And their legend says the way you would start counting that 520 years is when the pale man with a dark beard appeared in their hemisphere, which would have been Christopher Columbus appearing in their hemisphere in 1492. Well, 1492 and 520 years is 2012. So I think that's how they came up with it.
Well, it could be. A man that really knows that well is John Major Jenkins, mm-hmm. foremost Mayan scholar. He's going to be at our conference in Sedona on November 11th and 12th. If you can make it, come along. He wrote the book called Galactic Alignment 2012, and I think he'll speak to that. He does interpret the cycles a little bit differently from what I understand.
Well, I thought I'd run the theory by you and wait to see what you thought.
Yeah, it's good food for thought. I'm going to run it by John.
Okay. Good talking.
You know, I've always thought, Walter, that 2012, there will either be some kind of polar shift that they were aware of or some kind of period of enlightenment. That's my theory.
I kind of intuitively lean towards that. You know, I think the trends are getting very positive. They talk about it will bring about a new time also. And, you know, a personal hope is it will once again be conscious of the great year. You know, it's not just the day spinning, Earth spinning on its axis, or the year, the Earth going around the sun, that we'll finally be conscious of there's an even bigger cycle. And that really changes, you know, the way we look at archaeology and the way we treat ancient knowledge. Right now we tend to denigrate the ancients. If they came before us, they were more primitive, whereas I think there's really a great amount of wisdom there that we could use well at this time on our planet.
I think so too. East of the Rockies, your turn. You're on Coast to Coast with us. It's yours. Hi.
Hello, this is Vince.
Hello, Vince. Welcome to the show.
Great show. Lots of fascinating subjects.
Thank you.
My point is to make is I believe at the end of our solar system, where, you know, past Pluto, we have another body out there, and some type of planetoid. My belief is that's a dwarf star out there that keeps the solar system in check. I think, you know, between Jupiter, Uranus, and Neptune, such heavy planets, so big, why didn't they spin off? I just don't understand what kept it in check until I came up with this idea that there's a strong body out there that, you know, follows the circular motion of the solar system and keeps the back end in check.
Well, there's certainly a lot of scientists that are thinking that way, and as you know, they've found a couple of bodies here now that appear to be bigger than Pluto, and this is just, you know, in the last couple of months, and they found Sedna and Quarar right before that, almost as big. So, yeah, we're finding things left and right now. And this Pioneer 10 and 11 anomaly that we referred to earlier, the amount that they are off course indicates that there is some kind of mass equivalent to about 200 solar 200 Earth masses within the solar system. That's if normal Newtonian dynamics work.
That sounds good. That's kind of what I was thinking, and I'm just, you know, sitting on the bench.
Well, let's help find it. We've actually, at the Institute, started a little prize, and I haven't even sent out a press release, so I'll announce it here, George. It's called the Galileo Awards, and it's kind of like the X Prize, but you don't have to build a rocket. In this one, you can win $250,000 for finding the lost star, or there's another $100,000 prize and some increments if you can come up with a theory of gravity that makes a visible star make sense that it is linked to our sun. And all we're asking that it be accepted by the Astronomical Society.
Well, you're not asking for too much. Let's go to our West of the Rockies line. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Good evening, George. This is Bob from Anaheim. How
Hi,
are you?
Bob. I'm fine. Thank you.
I have a question for your guest with regard to we all are searching for something, and in those searches, we do various types of experimentation or what we call research. I think what we're looking at here is there's a couple of simple theories that perhaps your guest can elaborate on. That would be the attraction of a larger object to a smaller object or vice versa, and what would happen with a harmonic distortion interference of those two objects' attraction to each other. Maybe something that he could elaborate on in his research, what he may have found in ancient areas of research or in futuristic type thoughts.
So you're saying beyond gravitational effects, it's the when you say a harmonic, some sort of resonance or discordance that occurs between celestial bodies that has the effect of affects the rise and fall of the ages.
I'm not saying rise and fall of the ages, but I am saying that, for instance, an example in current times, which is something that we're experiencing in a current daily mode, such as we've burned, 50 billion gallons of oil in the past 125 years, and we'll burn that much oil in the next 10 years. And notice in society we've turned to using silicon as opposed to an oil-based product like plastic to produce product being a computer or a cell within a computer, which we would call our chip, rather than a 78 recording disc. So I think what we've realized is something that we're a carbon-based creature and we've moved to silicon. In other leaps in technology, coming up with silicon or coming up with the transistor seems to be a great leap forward in technology for our society. However, if we don't have the energy or power to fuel all these computers that have cost us a lot of dinosaurs or oil to produce and to continue running, what good is the technology, such as the fellow who built the Coral Castle? Mm-hmm. He says, I just used the technology that was used by somebody else. And I suggest that in string theory, we're talking about harmonics. We're talking about somebody having a theory of 64 million years. Happens to be 64 notes on the piano. There happens to be a lot of theory around harmonics or vibration. And that we may just all be, the end result, matter being the end result of a vibration. But I say that we know that we can take a very large object, suspend a very small object on a bar outside of it, allow it to move in an elliptical pattern, and there is an attraction of one object to another.
Well, I think you're raising a good point, and we still have a lot to learn. You know, the ancients seemed to take great care to live closer to nature and build things out of natural substances.
Well, they had no choice.
I'm not 100% sure of that, George. The work of Philip Callahan, shows that certain stones have a paramagnetic quality, and they seem to be beneficial to plant life. A lot of the round towers in Ireland, which, by the way, reflect are built in a pattern of some of the constellations of the Northern Hemisphere, seem plants grow better around some of them. And so it could be that they were sensitive to the vibrations created by different substances. And the point that the caller, or one of the points that he's making that struck me, is today we're producing so much stuff that generates so many vibrations, you know, from cell phones to computers to just the amount of stuff we're burning. I wonder if we are sensitive to what that is doing to the very subtle electric atmosphere that we have here and that we live in here on Earth.
Hey, by the way, you have also written and produced a documentary called The Great Year, right?
Yes, yeah. The Great Year is just a very quick summary of the book, and it's narrated by James Earl Jones. And
so could you get James Earl Jones on the show for an hour?
You know,
if you pull that off, I'll carry you around on my shoulder for a couple of days.
He's a wonderful, wonderful man, but I think he really respects his privacy. So
I just want him to say, yeah. This is CNN. Isn't he the voice of CNN?
He is Verizon, Darth Vader. He is the voice. He did a wonderful job, and he said he just loved the subject, so he did it for his nonprofit.
He's
price.
Great. I like to talk to him about Field of Dreams.
Oh, good.
Things like that, and Darth Vader and stuff. But if you can, if you talk to him, let him know. We'd love to chat with him on the program.
Would love to.
Walter, I want to thank you. Good luck again. Throw out the websites, would you?
Yes, LostStarBook.com. And have people check out this conference, too, where we'll have Graham Hancock and John Major Jenkins, Robert Schock, who redated the Sphinx. And that's CPAK2005.com. That takes place in Sedona.
Great. And say hi to Graham for me as well.
Will do. He said he'd love to come on the show again if you give him the opportunity.
Absolutely. Thanks, Walter.
Okay.
Appreciate Thanks, it. George. Great night. For Dan Galante, Steve Carr, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesour, who's putting in some yeoman's work for the next 2 weeks for the vacationing Lex Lonehood, Ian Punnett, Hart Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. I'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.